personally think that this question is, can be rephrased as the question, how does Mathieu moonshine work? I do believe we need a geometric approach to explaining Mathieu moonshine. That's a belief. And I do believe that the elliptic genus is a source for geometry in Mathieu moonshine, and that we have to get a better understanding of the elliptic genus in order to make progress in that effect. And I'm going to try to convince you that the study of the elliptic genus is interesting anyway, independently of Mathieu moonshine. So we'll see things that work a little more generally. So here's the plan of the talk. I will first remind you of geometric definition of the elliptic genus of Calabi-Yau manifolds. Now, that's clearly work done by other people, but I've kind of summarized my viewpoints in these two review articles, and we'll also touch upon ongoing work with Scott Carnahan and my student Felix Grimm. And, well, then we'll ask the question that's actually the title of the talk, namely, what happens to the elliptic genus when we consider it in the case where n equal to 2 supersymmetry is extended to some other larger algebra, and how does that affect the elliptic genus? But more importantly, how does that affect the geometric structures underlying the elliptic genus? So here I'm going to talk about work in progress together with Thomas Kreuzig, and also about kind of the basis of the program that I've been running together with Anne Taormina, because this will be a motivation for our symmetry surfing ideas, and I will turn to the symmetry surfing ideas in part three of the talk, and that's supposed to set the stage for Anne's talk tomorrow, where you will see more details, so that touches on these three papers together with Anne. All right, what's the elliptic genus? Well, in all of this talk, M will be a Calabi-Yau default, and the central player for the elliptic genus is this virtual bundle, EQ minus Y. So the definition is written up here, and you have to disentangle the notation a little bit, but what it really is, it's a formal power series in Q and Y, and its inverse. And then when you expand all this using that definition here, you'll see indeed it's a formal power series in these three formal variables, and each coefficient is a bundle, or a virtual bundle cooked up from polynomials in the dual of our holomorphic tangent bundle and the holomorphic tangent bundle itself. So this bundle will be very, or virtual bundle will be very, very important, and it's useful to look at it in order to define the elliptic genus, because then the definition of the elliptic genus is very simple. The elliptic genus is just the holomorphic Euler characteristic of this guy. By which I mean, do this expansion in Q and Y and Y to the minus one, and then take the traditional geometric holomorphic Euler characteristic of every virtual bundle that occurs there. And then, I mean, this is a shorthand geometric expression for this definition. It's just the usual Atiyah-Singer index version of calculating the holomorphic Euler characteristic. And the whole thing becomes a function of two complex variables with our usual notation for Q and Y and tau and z. Now, writing it this way should remind you of the fact that we can express the holomorphic Euler characteristic of a bundle in terms of the Chern classes. So we can rewrite this expression by using the total Chern class of our manifold M, and using the splitting principle, we can write this in terms of the so-called Chern roots. And then the integrand here even looks more familiar maybe to many of you. Namely, it becomes the quotient of two theta functions. Where theta 1 is just a traditional Jacobi theta function, like so. And using this expression, you can trace things back to this weird virtual bundle up there. When you take the quotient of the two theta functions, these common prefactors cancel out. This guy here takes care of the correct prefactor right there. And then here in the numerator and denominator, respectively, you see the contributions from the exterior bundles and the symmetric bundles respectively. However, one has to be a little bit careful with the first factor here. K equal to 1, of course, doesn't see any Q contribution. That's okay. K equal to 1 with no Q contribution gives you, in the denominator, the contributions from here. And in the numerator, actually, I have to exclude K equals to 1 when I compare to this guy here, and in particular with the symmetric functions. The K equal to 1 contribution here together with, there's a mistake here, sorry, this should be minus xj. Doesn't make sense otherwise. So in the denominator, you see the e to the minus xj contributions from here, and when k is equal to 1, actually it doesn't occur in this infinite product here, which just vanished. In this infinite product, that contribution, actually the k equal to 1 contribution, is taken care of by the terms in the Todd genus in this expression here. So I'm making this point because, of course, you can relate this expression to more classically known things. If we send Q equal to 0, at least formally, what we get is the Euler characteristic of this guy here, minus y. And that's just the traditional Euler characteristic graded by y. So that's graded Euler. I think this is a useful approach to the elliptic genus for various reasons. First of all, if I use this Atiyah-Singer index language, you immediately see that we've written down a topological invariant for M. Also, this expression here is close to the history of the elliptic genus, which was invented as a regularized version of the index of a Dirac operator on the loop space of M, and then this limit is something like the no-loop limit. Get rid of all the loopy terms. The stuff which is black up here. And last not least, if I write the expression like this, you immediately see that there is some modular property built in, modular invariants with respect to tau and z, because here we have the theta ones. All right, so modularity is of course something nice, and we will all look for a CFT or a vertex algebra if we see a modular function, and indeed, of course, this is expected. We expect to reproduce the elliptic genus in terms of conformal field theory as a supertrace of an Hilbert Schwarz sector if we have a conformal field theory with an Hilbert Schwarz sector like so, which is obtained as nonlinear sigma model on M. So for CFT, or superconformal field theory, which is a nonlinear sigma model on M. And then in here, I have to write y to the j naught minus c by 6, c the central charge, and q, and here as a shorthand, I use L naught top, which is L top, like so. There's a question. Well, that's why I'm writing it in this contorted way. I can use spectral flow and rewrite everything in terms of Ramon sector. That's why I'm using a slightly untraditional expression here. I want to write Nivers-Schwarz sector because really we're after vertex algebra, and that's better than in the Nivers-Schwarz sector. So that's why I'm writing it this way. I don't want to introduce the Ramon sector, but it's the same thing that you're used to, of course. Say again?
Is there a minus 1 to the genome, or is that also a job in your...
Super. And that's important, of course. Okay, and well, the problem is that very often we don't really know how to construct these nonlinear sigma models. At least this is okay in some examples. This is okay if M is a torus. And I guess it's also okay for its orbifolds. And then if we talk a little longer about Gapner models, we'll also agree that this is okay for Gapner models, but then kind of that's it. I'll come to that next transparency. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this is kind of very, very inefficient if we're just starting from this holomorphic elliptic genus, from this function that doesn't see any anti-holomorphic contributions. And then I'm suggesting that we should use the entire Nivers-Schwarz sector with anti-holomorphic and holomorphic contributions of a full-fledged CFD. That seems very, very inefficient because all the anti-holomorphic stuff is not visible in the elliptic genus. And then, indeed, there's more efficient or a seemingly more efficient proposal due to Malikov, Schechtmann, and Weintraub, who construct the so-called chiral Durham complex. So it's actually copied from the old string theory literature, I would say, because what you do is you take a holomorphic coordinate chart, and on that holomorphic coordinate chart, you associate to the open neighborhood there, you associate a Fock space, literally the Fock space of D copies of a BC beta gamma system, where if you want to think geometrically, you should think of the various fields here as picking up these holomorphic geometric quantities. Then you have to start gluing, but you know how to do that. You glue on overlaps of distinct holomorphic coordinate charts by just using the geometric prescriptions on what happens to these geometric data. Yeah, exactly. These are the fermions, and these are the bosons. Yes, exactly. And then you have to work a little bit and show that actually what you have constructed is a sheaf. It's a sheaf of vertex algebras because these BC beta gamma systems are actually quite well under control. And this sheaf is called the chiral Durham complex for reasons that I will not explain here. However, from this sheaf of vertex algebras, the proposal is that one can actually construct a proper vertex operator algebra associated to M. Here we have a sheaf, so that's not quite good enough. But the proposal here, and it's proved, in I think even in an Inventiones paper by Borisov and Lipkova, that the cohomology, the sheaf cohomology of this sheaf of vertex algebras actually carries the structure of a topological n equal to superconformal vertex algebra. And a superconformal structure you can already see at the level of the chiral Durham complex. You can write down the fields which descend to cohomology and which actually already up there are globally defined, but of course they're cooked up from those pieces that are just locally defined in terms of coordinates over there. And then if you start it a little bit, almost by construction, you observe that the elliptic genus now is recovered as the bigraded Euler characteristic of this guy. And you can see this in these expressions here. Back to your question, of course, we have the fermions here picking up the terms from the exterior powers. So that would be rho j.
So that's the sheaf cohomology.
That's sheaf cohomology. Exactly. That's very important. I didn't introduce the chiral Durham anyway because I didn't need it. And here, indeed, this is sheaf cohomology, and that's why you get something infinite dimensional there. Yeah. And here, oops. You have the other fermion, which I called psi here. And here we have the bosons. This is rho. And this is phi j k minus 1. And then you can go through the math and you see that actually the graded Euler characteristic quite immediately gives you back this expression with the infinite polynomials here, with the infinite products there. Okay, so that looks very good because now we have a map. It's even factorial. We have something that starts from a Calabi-Yau and then associates to it a vertex algebra. And then taking the Euler characteristic, we reproduce the elliptic genus. However, unfortunately, this chiral Durham complex is a terrible beast. It's a sheaf, but it's not a coherent sheaf for those of you who know what that means. And the culprit, actually, the thing that makes it so difficult is, in fact, the zero mode of phi j here. The zero mode of phi j, which in this expression up there where I used the holomorphic Euler characteristic, the zero mode actually was moved to the expression which wasn't taken care of by the bundle EQ minus y. And this is why, not very surprisingly, if we use as a model this bundle EQ minus Y, we're in much better shape. This is mathematically a much simpler object. It's a bundle of vertex algebras. It doesn't suffer from all the problems that the chiral Durham complex there has.
You mean you put a vertex algebra structure on a tensor
product? Exactly, exactly. Exactly. And I mean, all that happens is that I go to the graded object, which is better, and it kills the zero mode, and that makes it much better behaved. And it has a geometric origin, which is something I like. All right, so as I said at the beginning, this guy will be very important in what follows. And still there are a number of open questions now, literally open questions. First of all, we would like to know examples of where this vertex algebra from the chiral Ram complex can be calculated. So calculate VOA. That's actually disappointing. I said we don't know how to construct these nonlinear sigma models, so let's look at the chiral Ram complex instead, but we can't calculate this either, so it's not really. But it has less structure, so maybe we're in better shape here. And, well, what else?
There are a few examples,
yes. They're toric constructions, and in particular, the cases that are okay up there also work. So this is in particular okay for complex tori. And now enjoin. Say again? Probably, yes, symmetric spaces of that. I mean, all these constructions should go through directly. And then what we can do now is also Z2, let's say comma K3s, to be precise. But another question where I don't really know the answer is the following. I mean, in the construction here, I used the complex structure of the manifold M. So the chiral Ram complex, by construction, depends on a choice of complex structure. And so should the vertex algebra. But how much of this dependency is really there is not clear. Because if we look into the simple examples where we can actually do the calculation straightforwardly, we actually find that in both these cases, there's no dependence on any geometric quantities here. And so in particular, for all the Kummer K3s, we have one vertex algebra, one stable fixed vertex algebra, which is associated to all of them. And of course, I like that because I'm looking for a vertex algebra that explains the elliptic genus in a nice way. All right. And then finally, a question which has to do with some expectation up there. Of course, I would like to know how precisely this vertex algebra here is related to a vertex algebra that I can obtain from a nonlinear sigma model relation to a nonlinear sigma model. And there's a proposal and quite a good understanding on how that should work using Witten's topologically half-twisted model. And then Kapustin showed how to deal with this. But unfortunately, you also have to use something like a large volume limit. So the details here are not entirely clear to me, at least. So in general, it's not so clear how to translate back from the structure that you might obtain from the chiral Ram complex into a general nonlinear sigma model. But in these two cases, that's actually OK. Say again? Well, that's work in progress with Scott Carnahan and my student Felix Krim. So calculation is there already, but it's not written up yet.
The half-twisted model gives you something natural even away from the limit of
yes.
radius.
Yes, exactly.
It's not a natural mathematical object. I mean,
it is, but there seem to be correction terms. Which you have to get rid of in order to compare.
So you do have a dependence.
Exactly. We don't have a dependence on the Keller moduli. Exactly, in the chiral Ram. In the chiral Ram. Yes.
So it suggests there's a more natural mathematical object which would give the BOA that comes from the half-twisted model of all.
Well, there is a natural object, namely the nonlinear sigma model, just we don't know how to calculate it. So, I mean, I want to calculate conformal field theories on all K3 surfaces, and this might be a route to do that, because here I see more mathematical structure helping me. However, then I have to make the way back to the nonlinear sigma model. So, literally, I want to understand the connection between the two. And yes, of course, I mean, we want to find a nice vertex algebra underlying the elliptic genus, but that's already here. See, I don't know what to expect. Because we have this, I mean, all the moduli dropping out for the Kummer K3s It seems to me that it's quite possible that there's one general vertex algebra associated to the elliptic genus, which doesn't change over K3 moduli space, but that's no more than a belief. I mean, I don't have any kind of mathematical argument to support that. Other than that, it's already surprising that all the geometric moduli drop out in this construction here. All right. No.
The vertex algebra you get, what is the central charge?
Six.
Is it self dual?
Is it
central?
Six. 3D. Well, I mean, the topological, I mean, here I'm working with the topological model, so the central charge isn't zero, really. But then when I twist back, yeah, I mean. So, yeah.
So, is it independent of complex structure and four surfaces or K3 in general? Should you be able to prove that by looking at sigma model and showing the deformations or q-bar or something?
Nobody has done this. I mean, even as I said, I mean, even this calculation here, which is quite straightforward, you know, a little bit about the orbifold constructions and CFTs, even this calculation here is not written up anywhere. There's work by Szczesny and Frankel, I think, and Elwani, who calculate the orbifold version of the chiral de Rham complex, but they don't really equip it with a full vertex algebra structure. They only construct the Riazoro model structure on the twisted sectors. So there's a little bit missing here. But since we know all these techniques from CFTs, it's kind of straightforward to do this calculation, but it's not written up anywhere. Yeah.
But the theory is to help you.
No, not that. I mean, I don't know actually, but I don't think so. No, probably not. Yes. Yes.
But does it have any special features? Do you know anything about it other than?
I can write it down. I mean, it's just what you expect that it is. But wait for the paper.
I mean, the DOA.
Yeah. All right, so there is something. I mean, I'm talking about ongoing work, so I don't want to go into more details right now, but there is something, and I think it's kind of believable that one can do this calculation. I mean, it's it's hard work, but it's doable. All right, now that's all essentially about the elliptic genus in general and about its interpretation. I'm trying to tell you that this bundle E here is very, very good and very, very nicely behaved because it's much simpler than the chiral de Rham complex. And from it, just by taking holomorphic Euler characteristics, I can recover the elliptic genus. But now, of course, we're on the moonshine workshop here, and we know that the elliptic genus is sort of the origin of Mathieu moonshine phenomena. And what happens there is that we actually decompose the elliptic genus by a recipe that we learned from CFT. Namely, if we are in the situation which has disappeared here, if the elliptic genus, the geometric elliptic genus, is obtained through the supertrace of an Evers Schwartz sector of some stuff in the nonlinear sigma model. And if for this nonlinear sigma model we have extended supersymmetry, say, with extended supersymmetry, then we can go ahead and decompose this character here into characters of irreducible representations, say, of the extended chiral algebra. Decompose. And we know that that's a nice thing to do because this is actually the basic idea behind the first observations in Mathieu moonshine. Well, that's then the case that I, of course, favor. Now we're restricted to the case where the complex dimension is 2, the central charge is 6, the superconformal algebra is extended to an n equal 4 for a superconformal algebra, and then this decomposition is actually not very hard to write down. We only have 3 types of characters to take care of, the vacuum, massless matter, and then the family of massive matter, and we all know and love this decomposition here, where we know that the AN are the interesting coefficients which somehow relate to representations of M24. And that's the crucial observation by Eguchi, Oguri, and Tashikawa. And then I think almost every member of this audience has contributed to make this conjecture precise, and then, of course, the common knowledge in Terry Gannon's proof of the fact that actually An can be interpreted as the dimension of an appropriately chosen representation Rn of M24. All right, but we still don't know why this is so. We don't really know how to interpret these representations Rn in a nice intrinsic way. And I'm claiming, well, really, we should use a geometric approach. We should go back to the structures underlying the elliptic genus and look back at this equation here. Because, of course, this decomposition here was not done in a geometrically motivated way. We used N equal 4 supersymmetry because we knew that we could recover our elliptic genus from a nonlinear sigma model. An equation like this, where I recover this index in terms of a supertrace, is actually a structure which is known in index theorem, in index theory, like a McKean-Singer index formula. And I take that as, well, encouragement to actually use more ideas from index theory in order to get behind what's happening here. And there's a version of the index theorem which is a local version of the index theorem, and that essentially encourages you to take a closer look at the integrand here rather than integrating out. And then by staring at that, one finds that really one gets encouraged to work with this bundle more directly, namely, instead of decomposing the character where we kind of lose control over the underlying structure, the motto really is to decompose the bundle itself. Because remember, we have this index theorem here, and now the conjecture, and I put that into one of the review articles that I cited earlier. The conjecture is that at least in the case where M is equal to K3, instead of decomposing the character, what we should do is decompose this bundle, by which I mean, well, this is a Pomer power series in Q, Y, and Y to the minus 1, with coefficients given by some combinations of T and its higher powers. And now I can rearrange things so that I collect the Q and Y dependence into the characters of the irreducible representations of N equal 4, and then the prefactors, and that's the conjecture, the prefactors will still be expressible in terms of nice bundles. Because if that is the case, then I've constructed a geometric object which gives me back those numbers over there. P and T then will be a virtual holomorphic bundle whose holomorphic Euler characteristic reproduces precisely these numbers here. All right, now I need more space. Not clear. That would be nice. And there I need symmetry surfing, but I'll get to that. There we need, say again? I'll talk about that later, yes. Okay. It's not clear, and I don't think they are in general. Yes. All right, but actually first, I mean, I'll take it step by step. I'll first prove this conjecture, and that's actually not very hard. The proof is also not written up yet, but it's written up yet, but not on on the archive, because we want to extend the results. This is with Thomas Kreuzig. And actually what we use is some of the techniques that you can find in the paper by Thomas Kreuzig and Gerald Höhn. And once you know how to do it, it's actually quite easy, because the only observation you need is in fact the fact that T here is an SU2 principal bundle. And therefore, also EQ minus Y is a virtual SU2 principal bundle, so now I can use the holonomy distribution to decompose this. where the mn here are just multiplicities, and the wn here run through the irreducible representations of SU2. So this is the n-dimensional irrep SU2, of which we know what it looks like. This is just Sn minus 1t. And now we take the crucial extra information that the action of the n equal 4 now is completely on the multiplicity space, because the way we construct the n equal 4 superconformal algebra from this bundle EQ minus Y is actually intrinsically made up in the way so that the n equal 4 algebra is invariant under SU2, because since invariant. So then I'm actually there. I can rewrite this like so, where these multiplicities here, now it's the graded multiplicities with Q and Y put in again, but they have to decompose into characters of n equal 4. Characters, n equal 4 characters. Sums of n equal 4 characters. And that's it. Of course, up to a simple calculation where you check that the leading order coefficients. Exactly. And you see that immediately in the free field expressions, etc. So that's actually very, very simple proof. And again, I mean, now I have to check these two coefficients, but that's, of course, very, very easy by direct calculation. And you see immediately that this actually, this generalizes. All I needed to know here was the fact that I was starting with an SU2 principal bundle because I have extended holonomy. And now I'm back to your talk. Actually, this construction here should work in all the cases where you have more interesting holonomy groups. So this is why we haven't put it up yet. It's just a very, very short proof. So we're working on a generalization and to see how much it teaches us in general. All right, so this is, of course, completely independent of Mathieu Moonshine. Oh, there's a question.
Do you expect that there's some sense in which you can deform the K3 or generic points of moduli space that the letter character is coming only from terms with certain signs?
I don't know, actually. Yeah, that's a problem here. Exactly. I mean, here, what I really need to do is first construct this bundle, which is a virtual bundle in general, and then even I have to descend to a cohomology. So I get further signs and cancellations in here. So I hope so, of course. Yes, exactly. So, of course, I'm hoping that we will find representatives just in one degree here, and just in, or back to your question, kind of that the virtuality of the bundle is not going to be a problem, but I didn't even test run things here. All we know from the work with Anne is that R1 seems to be very well behaved. R1, actually, P1 is just the second symmetric power of T. So, there, I don't have any virtual stuff going on, actually. Okay, but back to Mathieu Moonshine, of course, this is kind of a step towards constructing some geometric object which also carries a vertex algebra structure, which could feature, something that carries the M24 action at the end of the day. Yeah, but we ignore the anthropomorphic stuff, of course. And in the Karl de Raam construction, you don't even have the anti-holomorphic stuff a priori. You need to introduce a little bit of anti-holomorphic stuff when you calculate the cohomology. So at least in Kapustin's work, he uses a certain resolution where you introduce trivial vertex algebras on the anti-holomorphic side. So it's just the zero modes of the fields and you don't have any interesting VOA there. All right, so what we have now is my favorite bundle, EQ minus Y, and it's a bundle of vertex algebras. This is now purely holomorphic, and then we have to add some stuff, in particular the zero modes, and descend to cohomology, and then we obtain the vertex algebra from the chiral-Durham complex. And what we've achieved here is now to break this up in nice pieces, namely the PNT together with the N equal 4 action, if you want. And here we have a geometric object which underlies, which at least has the right Euler characteristic to give back our favorite M24 related numbers. And now, of course, I'm asking exactly the question that the audience has already asked. We know that this has something to do with M24. Where on earth should an action of M24 come from? Over here. Now, from the geometric approach, of course, I at least know that all the geometric symmetry groups of K3 surfaces will have a natural action here now, right? Because they act on T, and then that descends. And that's actually, even in the chiral-Durham literature, they studied this. As I said earlier, this is factorial, really. So that's fine. So if we take subgroups of M24, which come from geometric symmetry groups, then we're fine. Now, we want to collect all these symmetry groups. That's the basic idea behind Anne and my work. We want to collect these symmetry groups on something that is stable in moduli space. And in our work, we have used different things to collect these symmetries, kind of an increasing order of understanding, maybe. But here, we may have a vertex algebra, which actually is stable on all of K3 moduli space. At least it's stable for all the Kummer, all the Z2 RB-fold conformal field theory. So that's a good object to calculate, to collect symmetries. So glad about all the questions, but I only have 5 more minutes, so I'm going to speed up now a little bit. I wanted to give you a little bit of an idea behind the symmetry surfing, because to me, it is motivated by observations like this here. So what we want to do here, is take some object that is fixed as we move through moduli space and use it in order to collect symmetries. And that, of course, sounds very vague, but an important ingredient in this idea is actually the fact that we work on a cover of the moduli space, so that all the things that we do are actually a priori allowed. So first comment here is work on a cover of moduli space. And that's actually a high order cover, if you want. And since we don't really know how to proceed away from the Z2 orbifolds, I can only tell you what kind of choices we have to make for the Z2 orbifolds. So for example, for Z2 orbifold CFTs, what we choose is a geometric interpretation, essentially of the underlying toroidal theory. So T lambda is a complex two torus. So we have to fix this lattice lambda, to be explicit. That's part of choosing the geometric interpretation. But in addition to that, we need to observe that, of course, the fixed points of Z2 here are the interesting part in the additional geometry for K3. And they're labeled by the half lattice vectors, which sit in an F2 to the 4. And in fact, we also have to choose an identification here. And that's quite important. So here we're sitting in a cover of a moduli space where we are making a lot of additional choices.
I'm sorry, what's the
say again? So a cover of moduli space of conformal field theories, let's say, or let's say nonlinear sigma models. all the geometric interpretations of one and the same theory, and then I want to restrict my attention now to geometric interpretations in terms of the Kummer construction here. So I have to choose, all possible ways of choosing a different lattice lambda here. There's already a little bit of duality in there. And then in addition, I mean, all the possible choices of this isomorphism here. Yes, so there's quite a lot, yes. But for the experts, this means that we have chosen, for all the Kummer K3s, we have chosen a common marking by making these choices. Actually, for all the Kummer K3s, let me take all of cohomology here. All these choices allow me to write down an identification of the integral cohomology of my K3 surfaces with a standard lattice. And now I can come back to your question, how can I do symmetry surfing when I'm working with something that doesn't seem to even depend on the complex structure? Well, this seems to be, this vertex algebra seems to be something which is the same all over moduli space, but the symmetry group will be incredibly large, and I don't want all those symmetries. I want those symmetries which at a given point in moduli space are actually coming from geometric symmetries. And to say which symmetry is geometric will depend on some kind of integral structure sitting in the cohomology. And then if this lattice is mapped onto itself or not, that is going to be deciding whether I'm looking at a symmetry or not. So
why do you want the advanced symmetry group?
Because it's not M24.
If it contains M24, that would be good.
Say again?
If it contains M24?
Yeah, but it's just no structure. It's a huge symmetry group. I mean, it's just not very interesting to look at it.
Which symmetry group are you talking about?
Of the vertex algebra, the symmetry group of the vertex algebra that we find here. Yes. Because I've stripped off all the structure, I mean, of course, it has a huge symmetry group. It's even a continuous group, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, it's not bad, but it doesn't. I don't see any relation to M24 at this point. Yes.
But I mean, should we have to inherit that? Or are you saying that the automorphism group, this VOA, is artificially large and the elliptic gain that you're interested in would not see any trace?
That's right, because in some sense, at the moment, now it kind of catches me. I'm only working on this bundle here, on this abstract thing, and I've not included the zero modes of the, or if you want, the coordinate functions on M. So that's geometrically the reason why the full-fledged symmetry group there is not what we're looking for.
But M24 should be a subgroup of that?
Sure. Yes.
But this is not
a revolutionary idea. I mean, this is just exactly how we talk about symmetries for K3 surfaces. We've heard about the Torelli theorem from you. I mean, here we're looking at a rank 24 lattice which sits in some 24-dimensional space with symmetry with signature, and the isometry group here is not very interesting. At least that's a Lie group. Fine, and then that's it. It's interesting, okay. I mean, let's not talk about taste. But in here, I can single out at any point of the moduli space, I can single out those maps that are actually symmetries. And that depends on the way this lattice here is embedded in here, and then I have to check whether I'm actually looking at lattice automorphisms. And all I'm saying is that something similar will be going on here. We're looking at a vertex algebra that is the same vertex algebra at every point of the moduli space, just as R420 is the same everywhere. But I'll have to find an integral structure in there which tells me at every point in moduli space what these symmetries are. And that integral structure will probably at least depend on the complex structures.
But you don't know the interpretation of the integral structure from the point of view of the
VOA. No, that's the next step to do. I mean, some of it we know, of course. And in some special points of the moduli space we know. And for the Kajal-Duram complex, Do you have the traditional cohomology of K3 sitting in there? And there I know what the integral structure is, but there's still a lot of work to do in order to make sense out of this stuff here. No. All right, I think I've run out of time, so unfortunately I didn't really pave the way for Anna, who's going to have to explain more tomorrow, maybe just...
If it is short, everyone else can add
some. Okay, okay. Well, I can continue. I can continue another hour if you want. Okay. Right. I said this. Exactly, and I already said this now at every point in moduli space. I already said this, but let me write this. At every point in moduli space, then we will know what the geometric symmetry group is. Which definitely acts on the on our PNT then. Now, in my work with Anne, as I said, we've used different things to collect symmetries then. In the sense of Mukai's theorem, or here in, if I want to formulate it completely, dropping off Keller geometry, I say I'm looking at at finite groups of biholomorphic maps on my K3 surface. So here we're kind of talking at a picture which only takes care of the complex structure, so that language is fine, but we know that the finite groups are precisely those that leave invariant some Keller form, so I can recover the usual language like that. Yes, indeed. In particular, this then is a subgroup of M24. Okay. In fact, N23. So, with N in our first work, we actually used what we now call a Niemeyer marking to collect symmetries. What we did there was we looked at two special points in the moduli space. And we already know that we have a marking, so if I write this lattice, I want to view it as the lattice that's already identified with some fixed standard lattice over here. And then we wrote down a bijective map, theta, to the Niemeyer lattice with root system A124. This was a bijective map, which on a rank 20 sublattice induced an isometry even. And then one can argue, I mean, this, if you like to think about deformations, one can deform these two special points into one another in a way so that theta survives the whole process. So in some sense, this is the geometric picture of symmetry surfing. You can surf through moduli space, keep this map. It's not an isometry, definitely not, can't. But it's a bijective map, and there are lots of choices. There are lots of choices. However, this allows us to carry the action of our geometric symmetry groups here to actions over here, where the symmetry groups coming from different points in moduli space live happily together and actually generate a larger group. And although we're making a lot of choices for theta, in fact, the action of these groups over here are independent of all those choices as soon as I've made the choices that I've listed over there. So we have to work on a cover of the moduli space, but all the other stuff that we're saying here around the construction, including the way we write down this bijection, is irrelevant if you're only interested in the action of GK on this side. And so in this setting, the Niemeyer lattice here was the object by which we collected symmetries, and what we found for these particular points there in moduli space was the group that we called the overarching group. And then later we noticed that actually what we're doing,
This is still an M23,
but now I'm getting somewhere where we're not in M23, because then we notice actually what we're doing here in a very contorted way is collecting symmetries on F2 to the 4, which governs the entire geometry of the Kummer surfaces here, and once we notice that really we're collecting symmetries on F2 to the 4, we're actually able to connect symmetries of all the Kummer surfaces, and then on here we find the group set 2 to the 4 A8, which is not a subgroup of M23 and is rather a maximal subgroup of M24. And then actually in the Twist paper, we start looking at stuff that comes from CFT, and we're looking at R1 in the notation that I had earlier, and we're constructing R1 as a space of states that are common to all set to orbifold CFTs on K3. And so here we now have a structure which is intrinsic to conformal field theory and which allows us to collect the symmetries. And of course, we have the action of the very same group. And now this whole idea of collecting symmetries, and Anne will need this. Oh yeah, that's the proof. And we'll need this in his talk. I think it's easiest to understand it in the setting of F2 to the 4 here. So here are a few technical details on that. So we now need to talk about all geometric symmetry groups for Kummer surfaces. Let G be such a geometric symmetry group. And now by symmetry group, I mean a symmetry group which respects the complex structure of C2 and also the degenerate Kähler structure induced from the Kähler structure of C2 on your Kummer surface. And that's a very, very strong restriction. It means that the geometric symmetry group actually is one that descends from a geometric symmetry group up here. And kind of by construction or by our assumptions, it automatically has this form, where the Z2 to the 4 here acts by shifts on these half lattice vectors. It shifts the fixed points of the Z2 action, and G lambda descends from a linear symmetry group on the torus P lambda, so it's actually a subgroup of SO3. And if we want to write down all those groups, we can use Fujiki's classification of symmetry groups of 2 tori, and if you go through the details here, you'll find that G lambda has to be a subgroup of one of these 3 maximal groups. And I've written out for you even the lattices on which these, I mean, the lattices of the underlying torus on which these groups will act as symmetry groups.
Can you remind me why SO3 comes into it rather than SO4?
What's SU2 divided by Z2, if you want? Up here, we're working in a subgroup of SU2, and then I have performed the Z2 orbifolding, yes. But really, on the face of it, we're working in SU2, really. Now here, I'm writing down the lattices in a particular way. I'm actually telling you what the generators are, and that's our way of choosing this isomorphism here. Once I've chosen the generators, I can write down an explicit isomorphism. So here, if you ask which cover of the moduli space I'm going to, actually, I'm choosing the lattice, including my favorite set of generators for the lattice. All right. Now, having said that, this actually means that now I can transport the action of G lambda to an action on F2 to the 4, and we see immediately that all our groups G lambda k, here we are here, G lambda k, are now viewed as subgroups of the affine F2 to the 4, where I also then take along the shifts here in the affine F2 to the 4. And then over here, of course, I can start collecting these symmetry groups in here. They're just subgroups, and they obviously generate a larger group. And then it's not terribly surprising that actually we get the entire affine F2 to the 4. So then, using this good old theorem by Jordan, who proved that the GL4 F2 is A8, and thereby what we've produced is a nice subgroup of M24. It's actually a maximal subgroup. So it's in particular not. I look in the tables. I look in the atlas where they're listing all the maximum rules. Is it obvious?
Yes. Why is it good? Obvious? Yeah, if you're seeing everything inside of each lattice.
I see. Well, it's the. It fixes an octet.
It's a stabilizer
of an octet. It's the stabilizer of an octet.
And if you think about it in the octet, it's alternating A to the 4. And if you think about it on
yes.
the
yes.
the complement of the octet, that becomes affine GL4 too. Yes. And the matrix of
right. Okay. So these are the results, and Anne will tell you more about that. So first of all, by collecting all the Z2 orbifold, by collecting symmetries for all Z2 orbifold conformal field theories, we find a joint action of all these symmetry groups, which makes up this maximal subgroup of M24, which is not a subgroup of M23. That's why I like M24 better. So this, in some sense, it's just discussing F2 to the 4 here, which is good enough, because knowing the action on F2 to the 4, you can actually recover the entire action of the symmetries on the entire Komar K3 surface. So this is just an efficient way of describing it. And then this is the main result of our twist paper. And of course, we've done something very dangerous here. We've worked on a cover of the moduli space, so somehow we're blind to effects of monodromy, but we're not completely blind to them, and that's actually what the twist is about. Just very roughly, we can construct a 90-dimensional space of states that are common to all Z2 orbifold conformal field theories coming from toroidal theories. We can view this then as something that collects symmetry as a common representation space of this big group Z2 to the 4 times A8. And then we can compare with what we expect from Mathieu Moonshine. This is a 90-dimensional space, so we would like to realize it as the 45 plus 45 bar of M24, then, of course, restricted to this subgroup. And indeed, that's what we find. However, at each point of the moduli space, R1 naturally decomposes into 15 times 6. And this decomposition here changes as we surf along in moduli space. That's, in short, what the twist is about. So in some sense, this is an effect of monodromy. So we're not blind to it. It's just not harming us here. And indeed, we get the right representation.
Do you have massive states in the orbifold? Do you naturally see 231s and 770s and so forth as you go up?
That's what we hope. Yes. I mean, so far, this is the honest statement. We've looked at R1. Yes, and I'm not going to employ all graduate students to kind of go to higher levels. I think that's why we're stepping back here. I think we'll have to get more insight and understand really what this underlying structure is rather than calculating further examples here. But yeah, so thanks for your patience, and now I'm really done.